My deep appreciation of theater history was instilled in me by Tom Empey, a college mentor to me and hundreds of others. While teaching Greek theater terms, he would grab the fabric of his slacks and say, "You see these pants? Euripides, Eumenides," making light of content that could be considered rather dry and stuffy while still maintaining respect for the art, which is what I want to do with this podcast. For each episode, I invite a guest from the many paths my theater career has taken me down. I give my guest no idea what we'll be talking about, but they know we're going to find an outrageous story about theater history and perhaps get a better understanding about why we're still doing it after all these years. So welcome to Euripides Eumenides, and I am your host, Aaron Odom. Apocalypse, I said, why you wanna show up now? Just when the heart of my life was getting good. I'll give you one more chance. Walk on out of the door, yeah. Get your ass to getting where the getting is good. Good morrow, Eumenidites. This is Aaron Odom from Trident Theater, back with another episode of Euripides Eumenides, a theater history podcast. If you are just joining us, welcome to this colorful corner of the internet where we bring you a little bit closer to the art of theater on a bi-weekly basis. If you're a returning listener, I hope the last fortnight has treated you well. I want to thank all of you for downloading this episode. It's truly been a passion project for me, one that I'll never forget. But speaking of passion projects, I want to get right into today's episode, which deals with another labor of love. For this episode, I bring back recurring guest Brand Birtwistle. You may remember Brand from the episodes Private Lives 1983 and Shakespeare and Starlings in America. You may also remember that Brand is a Los Angeles-based film and television producer and runs his own company, The Brand Productions. You can go check his work out at, and literally, this is the URL, thebrand.productions. I'll have a link in the show notes. Brand has had an incredible career in producing. For any football fans, Brand produced a lot of the post-game concerts after NFL games for Thursday Night Football on Amazon Prime this year. But Brand has done all kinds of different media, so I was very excited to chat with him about the movie Chimes at Midnight, Orson Welles' love letter to the beloved Shakespeare character John Falstaff. I go into quite a bit of the history during the episode and its struggles with distribution, which may be why you've never heard of it, but now you can go watch the entire thing on Max. So for this episode, I wanted to do something a little different. I told Brand that I wanted him to watch the movie, and then we'd give our freshest reactions for recording, and that's exactly what we did. We set a time, and both finished the movie right before recording. So I would recommend that you watch the movie at some point. But if you're interested in the movie, I'll let you know there are plenty of spoilers ahead in this episode. In any case, here's the episode, Chimes at Midnight. I gotta say, I know from a producer standpoint, the last year or so has been difficult with the couple strikes that seem to last forever. And I think at this point now, like, just a lot of stuff is still kind of on hiatus because, yeah, it's still picking up after, you know, they got kicked in the gut, right?
Yeah, man. I mean, it's this last year was tough. If I'm not mistaken, this is the longest strike in history, recorded history.
Right? For those two, yeah, I think so. Yeah,
even outside of entertainment, just in general, that's the longest strike, or something like that. Yeah, I could totally be misspeaking. I could be just throwing that out right now. For sure, it's the longest in ours, but it's like one of the top longest strikes. But industry's slow getting back on its feet, and there's another potential looming strike. And I think everybody right now is really hoping that it's not going to happen. And everybody's like, let's work it out. Come on, let's get back. Because I know I would like to be working some more. Everybody else would like to be working some more. But on the other hand, you know, it's offered a lot of great opportunity to be writing and creating and putting some other things together so that I've got more ability to drive my own content. You know,
yes,
create my own story.
Yeah, I think that's really cool that we're looking back on some of that stuff, and we're finding a connection to things, because both you and I, like, in our creative process, it's got to speak to us, right? It's got to be something that if I was paying money to go have this entertainment provided for me, I'd want to see it. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, that has been something for me that may or may not have impeded my success at some point. I remember when I was doing after school program for high school students, you know, I had the non-musical every year, and then the musical was in the springtime, and everybody would come to the musical. But of course, for non-musicals, yes, there you go, jazz hands. Add them to everything. Hamlet would have been a lot more interesting with jazz hands.
To be
shaking a hat. Yeah, I love it. But it was suggested to me by our administrators, or one administrator, that to combat the problem of, you know, audiences not showing up as much for a non-musical, they just went, well, why don't you just do a musical? I'm like, man, it's not just that simple. And I'm like, plus the musicals that I would want to do probably are not going to be great for high school students.
Now I'm intrigued, Aaron.
Yeah. Well, but honestly, like, I would want to do something like a Heathers at the high school level, where, you know, it's really catchy stuff, and it's dealing with stuff that these kids are dealing with right now.
Yeah.
Instead of how many more fucking times do we have to do a Bye Bye Birdie? I mean, Jesus.
Yeah.
I mean, nothing against that musical. It's just like, hey, let's pull another one of these Silver Age musicals out of
it. I played Conrad when I was in high school, man.
Look like a Conrad Birdie, man.
Oh, yeah. Come on. Thank you, Aaron. Thank you very much. I mean, dude, come on. When we were in college, I remember very, very distinctly, not to shit on Pepperdine too much, but... they wouldn't do Damn Yankees because it had damn in the title. I was 21 years old. I was like, God damn it. This is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Well, you know? I mean, also, you know, it's a very conservative Christian campus, and your main antagonist is Satan.
Come on. Could it not be any more perfect?
I know. Right? But also, you're like, hey, look, let's talk about this on a, you know, literature level. I mean, do we teach Dr. Faustus? Yes, we do. We teach Dr. Faustus in your hallowed halls, but we can't do Damn Yankees because,
you know, but also, I mean, just being real, like, did you watch Euphoria, Aaron?
I have not seen that yet. I need to see Euphoria.
Wow. I'll tell you what, it's very theatrical. Yeah. Very, very theatrical. They do these incredible tableaus and they break the fourth wall in some really interesting ways. It's a beautiful piece of art, but it's also a very gritty real life look at what kids in high school are dealing with today and what they're exposed to today, which is so much further than beyond anything that you know, this conservative thought process is teaching. Like, when you're teaching that and they're like, well, this is the reality of my life, you know, I'm with you. Like, it's important to do art that is poignant.
Yeah. And you important know? To you, like it, that you're passionate about it and you can see yourself appreciating it.
Yeah.
Well, Brand, I think that is a perfect place to jump into our topic today, because this is definitely a labor of love project. But, you know, I usually don't tell my guests what we're going to be talking about, but this one I went, no, let's do this. Let's do like a reaction episode to a great film that has kind of been lost in time. And the film in question is Orson Welles' 1966 classic Chimes at Midnight.
Is it 66 or 56?
It was 66.
I think it's 56.
No,
is
no.
It? Okay.
I
mean, it was, I know that it was like, I don't know a lot about the film, apart from mm-hmm. watching it, but I do know that it was piecemeal. That it was his later in life passion project.
Yes.
That he worked over a long period of time putting it together. And
mm-hmm. Oh man, you have no idea how long this actually took him to really? Put together. Yes.
I mean, I felt the script I was just talking about, I started it 10 years ago, you know? So I believe, you know, like these are things that take long, 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 you know, and my career is also when I first started writing, I started writing out of passion. So I believe this is probably what he's doing. Right. And, mm-hmm. and my first screenplay is easily like a $60 to $80 million film. Well, nobody in their fucking right mind is going to give me that kind of funds to create something at that point. Now my career has more caught up and it's not at that point yet, but mm-hmm. I've been doing some very large scale productions. So writing something that's smaller and being able to say, hey, I've done this and this, give me funding to do the smaller thing, which is what right. I think this is. You know, I think that this wasn't the big Hollywood blockbuster that he had kind of wanted. It kind of was a sleeper and became recognized later in his life, right? Yeah. It wasn't until later that people really saw.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, to take five Shakespeare plays and put mm-hmm. them together into one screenplay in 2 hours. This is wild.
I know. Well, we're going to be talking about that just a little bit. But for my listeners, if you have not seen Chimes at Midnight, you can stream it right now on Max. But the overall story is it is taking parts of, let me see, which plays are they? Let's see. Henry the Fourth, Part One and Two, Henry the Fifth, Richard the Second, and the Merry Wives of Windsor, which all feature heavily the character of John Falstaff.
Yeah.
And really the story of it is more about Prince Hal ascending to the throne when his father passes away. And, you know, if you're mm-hmm. familiar with these at all, young Prince Hal is kind of a scamp. He enjoys being kind of mischievous and living life. But within a series of like a couple weeks, he is then demanded to now pick up where his father left off in the middle of all of these terrible squabbles between the houses of York and Lancaster over the legitimacy of the throne. So I'm no expert on the histories, Brand. Much less the Henriad, the Henriad, as they call it. And there's quite a bit of trivia that's needed to understand the many squabbles between those two houses. I mean, there's so many allegiances amongst the different factions that it can seem quite confusing. But really, it must be known for this story that war is going on and it directly affects Hal and it must be attended to, particularly by Hal. But overall, agree or disagree, the principal question of the story is this: which of his two air quotes fathers will be more influential to Prince Hal, his actual father, the king, or Falstaff?
Yeah. The juxtaposition of the two characters is really fascinating, mm-hmm. where the king is so poised and
oh my God.
Falstaff is larger than life and gluttonous and a liar and conniving, you know, and humorous. I mean, he's humorous and his hubris, mm-hmm. his hubris is incredible. His self-worth and his, mm-hmm. his almost narcissism, is incredible. You know, things when he's in his armor, you know, and you see him because he's so fat and it's just, he's just waddling around and they're, even when they're trying to get him on the horse and they drop him, you know, he's so ridiculous, but tragic.
Yes.
But tragic too, because of his hubris. He has that really beautiful, rich character. And, you know, when you're talking about the two fathers, I thought, and the aging and the changing, you really, the character arcs between Hal and Jack, or John, who they call them both,
yeah.
right?
Yep.
You watch both of them evolve in their time of life.
Yeah.
You know, for Hal, you watch him go from a foolish child to being the ruler of a company and being stoic and making uncomfortable choices. Like, he doesn't want to cast out his father figure at the end, but
yeah,
spoiler alert, you know, he knows that that's what he has to do in order for him to become the man that he needs to be to step into the role that he is. And on Falstaff's standpoint, it's him becoming an old man, right?
Yes.
It's him living in his youth and holding on to the youth of Hal and living vicariously through him, and in this kind of made up world of his own design, right?
Right.
Of how he sees himself and sees himself being a ruler, and to the point that he'll do any that. He will do what he has to get into that role, whether or not he's that, how he sees him, how he perceives himself, and how his actions are in contrast drastically.
That would be an interesting, like, psychological perspective to take. Like, how much of his bullshit does he actually believe? Or when he finds out that his bullshit isn't really true, to what extent does he go ahead and just create more bullshit?
Well, or potentially, is it when he can no longer do that? Is that why he dies? Is that, you know, he's not living in that world anymore. And when he gives up on that, is that why he gives up completely?
Yeah.
Know?
Yeah. I mean, I think both you and I, obviously, here we are talking so emphatically about it. We really enjoyed the film.
Yeah. Yeah, it was super interesting. Beautiful.
Yeah. Now, that's something I wanted to hit on because it is Orson Welles. I mean, I think everybody knows him from Citizen Kane and just how beautiful of a film that was. I mean, he broke filmmaking wide open in his time.
Yeah.
And this is very, very Wellesian in its display. I mean, I'm no cinematographer, but what I did appreciate was just how much he did use, like, darks and lights. And in 1966, there were investors that turned him down because they're like, well, we'd really rather you did this in color. He wanted it. He chose to make this film in black and white in 1966. Which I think is pretty interesting, but it also speaks to how he wanted the film to look. You know, it's very much in the same vein as Citizen Kane. It's black and white for a reason. So I'm kind of interested in your perspective as a filmmaker, or, you know, as a producer, what you thought of just how it was shot.
Well, the cinematography was fantastic.
It was beautiful.
It had this kind of mix of classic cinematography, like Kurosawa, truly moving pictures where they would frame an image and then move to another beautiful still image, right? Which I thought was incredible. But they also, one of the things that really caught me was the use of handheld camera.
Yeah.
There's a fair amount of handheld camera. And this is really early on to be doing that like that. Using the handheld camera gives it kind of a voyeuristic feel, right?
Yeah.
It makes you feel like you're present and you're in the room. It takes, you know, by taking it off of either the dolly or the sticks, you're creating a vitality to the shot,
right?
Where you're feeling like you're a part of the scene, and I thought that was really interesting. You see that a lot in the taverns, as they're in the tavern and goofing around and things. But then where it stuck out, and I thought this was just, I was really blown away, was in that battle sequence.
Oh, yes.
I mean,
yeah.
You see early like, you see Game of Thrones all over.
Yes.
You see, you see modern war films that are like, when they're rolling around in the mud and they're exhausted and they can barely even fight because they're so tired. I feel like it was so raw and in a budget, utilizing a small amount of extras to make that feel like such a massive war sequence was just phenomenal.
Yeah. I was hoping you would talk about that war scene for fans of the plays. This is the Battle of Shrewsbury, where, you know, it culminates in Prince Hal killing Harry Hotspur. And some of it that I thought was kind of interesting was how it was filmed fast. Like, they sped up the motion a little bit to just kind of intensify the feeling of, you know, two armies running at each other. And then there's just that great shot in so many of those kind of films where the tension is building. You're seeing the armies running at each other and then they collide. And then it's just this swarming mass of death,
and it's a long sequence.
Yes,
it's like 10 or 15 minute battle sequence. Like as it happened and it continued, I was like, holy shit, this is epic. this is awesome. And and you when you watch it, you see where it's been lifted throughout the years, you know. Band of Brothers.
I was thinking Braveheart.
That was really, truly spectacular sequence. But
yeah,
real quick, going back to what you were saying at the beginning, the black and white, I think that he did it so well in using like natural lighting and having these beams of light come from the windows and creating that epic, timely piece. But I think that black and white is also indicative of Falstaff, and he's not black and white. He's full of shit. You know, he's gray. he's kind of right. In this other, and you see the other characters like in that battle sequence. You see Hal dressed in the dark because he's still under the influence of Falstaff.
Yeah.
Right.
Where.
Who is the other
person? Hotspur.
Yeah, he's all in lighter armor and
very shiny and bright.
Shiny silver, right? Yeah. So I feel like that he was utilizing that a lot intentionally, and you know, and I mean, that's pretty common now for sure. And I'm sure, I mean, good light and darkness is a forever theme, right?
I think the choice to make that black and white even further forces that metaphor a little bit, because you only have a couple choices there. You either have dark or you have light. And I'm thinking back to those scenes in the throne room with the great austere king sitting on his, you know, on his pyramid, basically, with these 50-foot tall windows streaming in natural light, but they're like 4 feet across, so they're very thin. It all feels closed in, but there's light out in the world. That's very interesting.
I know that exact shot. It's beautiful. And then he's got like 50 knights standing there.
I loved that. I thought that was so funny. I'm like, so we're really concerned about these opposing forces coming in here, that we've got to have 90 guys with 10-foot long pikes standing in the throne room.
Right? Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, here, let's talk a little bit just about some history of the filmmaking. I thought you'd find these things pretty interesting. So this was filmed in Spain from September 1965 to March 1966. I might have that a year off. I can't remember. But it was like from September to March in one of those years. Beyond the setting of Spain being quite perfect for the story being told, it was also somewhat out of necessity. Wells had by then befriended Spanish film producer Emiliano Piedra, who really wanted Wells to create and film an adaptation of Treasure Island.
Oh, that, I would have liked to have seen Wells' Treasure Island. That would have been awesome.
He actually played Long John Silver in a Treasure Island a few years later. But check this out. This is so funny. So Wells agreed to Pietro's request on the condition that he could film Chimes at Midnight and Treasure Island simultaneously.
Yeah, right. First off, yes, there's obviously no way you'd shoot two movies simultaneously.
Ah, he's Orson Welles. He can do it.
In case people don't know, my average hours on set are anywhere from like 14 to 16 hours a day. Like the idea of doing, and it's not like it's done then, you know, it's like we're done. And then afterwards I'm having meetings. It's once you're in the middle of a film, it's all encompassing. It's 24/7 while you're doing it. So
yeah,
that's, but also I think what you're talking about right now is a great example of Falstaff being exemplary of,
oh my God,
Wells' character. He's so full of shit. He lied. He was notorious for manipulating people to get what he wanted. And here's a great example.
So, he convinced Piedra he could do it because lots of the sets and locations could be used for both films, right?
Okay.
Wells never intended to film Treasure Island.
Never. Yeah.
He cast all the actors in Chimes at Midnight as characters in Treasure Island, but did no filming for it. Not once. Although, you'll appreciate this. He did send some dailies of the ship from Treasure Island departing a harbor to Piedra to let him know everything was directly on schedule.
Amazing.
Oh man. And I don't know what came of that. I know he ran out of funding towards the end and he finally got American producer Harry Saltzman to put money in for the rest of it. But yeah, I mean, but at that point he's also Orson Welles, you know. He was one of the biggest celebrities of the 20th century.
He's going to do what he wants to do, you know. Like,
so here's another little fun piece of trivia. Wells had wanted Keith Baxter to play the part of Prince Hal, which he eventually did. And he did damn well. Like, that Prince Hal was fantastic.
Yeah.
His transition from the young little mischievous scamp to the man who's realized what shoes he's got to fill, it was impressive. But at one point, a young Anthony Hopkins heard of the filming of this movie and approached Wells directly about playing the part.
Whoa! That's crazy.
Wells looked Anthony Hopkins in the eye and told him that he'd already promised the role to Baxter.
Wow.
I mean, Hopkins wasn't as big in 1966, but I mean,
sure.
It was still Anthony Hopkins, man.
You know, I have a friend that it just got announced like last week or the week before. He cast Anthony Hopkins in a movie and I'll send you over the details. They're redoing the Island of Dr. Moreau.
I heard about that. Oh my God.
Yeah. And Hopkins is playing Moreau. It's called Eyes in the Trees, I believe is what it's called.
Wow.
Yeah.
That'll be awesome.
Right.
But hey, speaking of great actors, what a genius move to have John Gielgud play Henry IV.
Fantastic.
I mean, just give that man the chance to chew up scenery and he will do it amazing.
Yeah.
You know, at first you understand Hal's plight because you're like, this dad is no fun. But he's also the head of a country.
He's the king. He's not supposed to be fun. If your king is fun, your country's probably fucked, man. Like, you know? Have you ever seen Queen Elizabeth smile? Ever?
Mm-mm. Mm-mm.
Not even with her Yorkies. She's just like... Mm.
That takes me back to the early 90s when people were seeing Bill Clinton. They're like, well, he wears sunglasses and plays a saxophone. He eats at McDonald's. And
you're like, wow.
Well,
he did not inhale.
I did not. Anyway. Well, anyway, many consider this to be one of Wells' best works despite initial terrible reviews. Like you were saying, like when it first came out, it got tanked. But even Welles himself considered this his best movie, even over Citizen Kane.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Isn't that something?
This was his passion project though, right?
Right, exactly.
Like this was his baby. This is those things that you spend 10 years putting together because you want it to be just right, you know? Like, yep. How long did he spend?
Oh, I'm going to tell you here in a minute. I just got a couple other things I was going to tell you about.
I'm excited.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I'm excited.
So the movie had incredibly limited release or distribution after its release. In fact, in England, it was called Falstaff Chimes at Midnight. When it was out in America, it was just Chimes at Midnight. So I don't know why that choice was made, but
I can't help but think of Threat Level Midnight, which is from The Office, the Michael Scott classic. Anyway, go on. Diverging.
But anyway, this movie is fairly characteristic as far as its distribution in that most of Welles's movies had some sort of conflict over who actually owned the film. And so, honestly, this one was finally picked up by Janus Films in 2015, 50 years after its release, and distributed
in 2015?
Yes.
Whoa. You got to give it to Janus because they truly are the quintessential, like, anything Criterion is Janus, right? Like,
and yeah, this, like, is in the Criterion collection.
They truly did the best of the best classic films, you know. If it had Janus on it, I'm like, okay, this is worth a watch.
Yeah. I never before thought I'd be doing too much of a deep dive on the character of John Falstaff, nor that he would come to endear himself so much to me. But that's just the first half of the episode. In the second half, we see what Orson Welles thought Shakespeare had intended for Falstaff as a character and as a metaphor. Pretty impressive stuff. But before we do that, I'll encourage you, the listener, to connect to the show on social media. Both Euripides, Eumenides, and Trident Theater have accounts on Instagram. You can also just go to tridenttheater.com and use the Contact Us form to reach out directly. All that stuff aside, let's get back to Brand Birtwistle and the second half of this episode, Chimes at Midnight. So, you want to know the history of this passion project?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that's an unbelievable. I thought my movie hasn't been distributed. We finished it 2 years ago. I'm feeling like that's a long time. You know?
Yeah. Okay. So, if you don't know already, Orson Welles' lifelong obsession, at least one of them, was Shakespeare. He loved Shakespeare. There's some quote I read, and I didn't write it down here, but he was basically saying, like, Shakespeare is the only person who really truly understood the English language, and something like that. And you're like, wow, okay. So this is one of those things we've talked about on this show before, where, like, by 26, he had made, or 26 or 27, he had made Citizen Kane. He started writing this when he was about 16 in high school.
Wow.
And then a few years later, it actually started to come together in a play in 1939 called The Five Kings. And like I said, it was using actual Shakespearean text from Henry IV Part 1, Henry IV Part 2, Richard II, Henry V, and The Merry Wives of Windsor. So big time stuff. And this was announced to be in Wells Mercury Theater in New York City to be part of the lineup of the 1939 season. But they had to take it on tour first, see how it was going to land.
It was like 5.5 hours, right? Yes. Something unbelievable. I'm sorry if I just gave it away, but like, I remember that thinking, like, whoa. See, even my cat is like, that's crazy. I don't know if your cat's her just go, ah! She's like, damn, that's a long time.
Well, okay, so I'll get into that here in just a second. So yeah, the initial tour was supposed to play in Baltimore, Boston, D.C., then Philly, before it finally moved to the Mercury on Broadway. So Welles played Falstaff, He's like 24 years old at this point.
So he's going to play Falstaff.
Jeez.
And Burgess Meredith played Hal.
Oh, what?
Yep.
I don't know why it didn't work.
Well, let's see why. They didn't really attend too much of the early rehearsals, and quite often the other actors didn't have much of a script to rehearse because Wells hadn't completely finished it. He was too busy going out drinking with Burgess Meredith.
Fantastic.
We could rehearse, or let's just go get shit-faced. I'm down for that.
I've done some really great writing shit face. I would be lying if I said otherwise.
Now, due to this complete, like, they didn't have a script or anything, the Baltimore run was canceled. Okay, so on to Boston, right? During the initial rehearsals for the Boston run, that's where they realized that the script was over 5.5 hours long. So to meet the pressure from people going, hey, cut this down, people are never going to see it. Of the 46 scenes that Wells had written, he cut 14 of them and presented the play as The Five Kings Part One. So
God. You had to come see. We're going to cut it. We're going to cut it, but we're going to make it 8 hours, actually, rather than 5.5. But we're going to give them a really nice intermission in there. An all-day, get your King History dosage for your life.
Well, I mean, that's Angels in America. If you do all of Angels in America, it's 9 hours long.
Is it? I thought it was like 4 hours long.
Oh, no. One of them could be about part four. One,
yeah.
Yeah.
It's been a long time since I read that. Yeah.
Yeah. When they originally did it on Broadway, I guess they'd give you an hour and a half intermission to go have dinner. Like, but it would start at about 3 or 4 in the afternoon.
Wow. Yeah. That's a commitment, man.
That is a commitment.
When we did Lear at Pepperdine, it was 4.5 hour play.
God damn it.
I was Lear's understudy. I knew every line for 4.5 hours. Ooh. Now, I couldn't tell you a single. Howl. That's it. There it is.
Yeah. Howl. Cordelia, you're a shithead. That's all that. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. So back to The Five Kings Part One. When it premiered in Boston, it was an utter bomb, which caused the cancellation of the DC run. So now they've only got Philadelphia. After even further cuts, allowing the play to be just over 3 hours, unfortunately, the Philadelphia run was canceled after 3 performances, and it never made it to Broadway.
Wow.
Now check this out. That's 1939. It was revived by Wells as a one-person show in Ireland in 1960, which inspired him to write the screenplay we have today.
Wow. I mean, passion projects are no joke, man.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I think there's a certain part of directors that tends to be a little obsessive. And not all directors, but there's a certain amount of perfectionism, and that is completely unattainable, right? Because no matter what you think and dream in your brain, you have hundreds or thousands of people coming together to create one shared vision. So you know, you can only hold on to that so much, and ideally, a truly talented person like a Wells, you know, you understand that and you empower the people around you to further what was that you had initially thought of. But I mean, that is a true testament to storytelling. And you know, there's a part where I can relate to that because I have my opus in mind that I've been working on for over 15 years. And there's no reference that's quite like it. There's nothing that's been done there's things that are kind of similar here and there over the years, but nothing has quite been done. But in order to do that project, I know that I need to do A, B, and C first.
Right.
And in order to have that ability to say, this is what I'm going to do, and this is why I'm going to do it. Now you can't question me because you've seen me do this and this and this leading up to this, you know? Right. So you got to remember, it's show business, right? It's ultimately a business. Ultimately, at the end of the day, it's all an investment. It's investors that want to get their finance back.
Yep.
So much of filmmaking is a formula, you know? This script is going to get this actor and this actor who are going to guarantee that we're going to sell this amount of seats worldwide.
Right.
And once we know that, we know we can protect that investment. And because these aren't small funds, I'm very curious as to how much that movie costs to make and what that would translate to today, because,
I'll do some quick Googling.
the Google
initial budget, 800,000 in 1966.
Okay.
Let's go to an inflation calculator here.
What do we got?
This is fascinating listening, by the way.
Yeah.
He's Googling. I go, so. Boy.
Click, 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 click.
Okay.
And Google says
that calculates out to $7.8 million today.
That's not a lot of money.
No.
That's not a lot of money.
And he ran out.
Yeah, well, that makes sense to me. I mean, doing period pieces is first and foremost always expensive. Wardrobe, knight and armor, horses, you know, thinking about the horses and the amount of people you need to wrangle those and transport those, you know, that's expensive. Feeding those people don't think about those kind of things, right?
Oh, yeah.
But parking and feeding your people are massive. You know, luckily they didn't have to COVID test everybody going in, but
oh god.
You would not have, thank god that's done, but you would not have believed that increased our film budget by like 20%.
No kidding.
Yeah, because you had to be testing people at least 3 times a week.
Oh.
At least, you know. Oh. when I did my film in Oklahoma, was prior to Omicron being a thing.
Yeah.
And so we were planning on doing an antigen test once a week, which costs $175 to start our week off to make sure everybody coming back from the weekend was clean. And then doing PCR tests for $175. That's the higher end one. Then antigen tests, like our Wednesdays, Fridays as upkeep, right? Those are $20 a piece. When Omicron came out, it wasn't picked up by the antigen tests.
Right.
So we had to change all of our testing to PCR tests. So that was $175 per person 3 times a week.
Oh my God.
You know, per person. Ooh. Yeah.
Per person. And that includes not just your actors, that includes the crew members and just anybody coming to the set.
Anybody coming. Yeah. Yeah. And you had to do these zones where different people were only allowed to interact with different people to keep it safe and stuff. It's wild, but I can see like $7.5 million in today's market. There's absolutely zero chance you could make this film. There's no possibility. Right. You can't do a war film, let alone a medieval piece, you know. I wouldn't even know where that would begin. But the amount of background and just, I mean, there were so many costly elements in that.
Oh yeah.
Like,
yeah,
it's incredible. It's incredible to hear that to me as somebody that, like, I do line producing, I work in budgets. I schedule and budget, and that is very much an active part of my job. And when I hear that, I'm like, holy shit. Like, they made that dollar stretch, you know. And maybe it's also filming in Spain. They might have been able to bring some costs down, and no doubt the location costs were a lot less.
Yeah, it was a lot of location shots too. So yeah, I would imagine. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think there's something about it, especially since, it was, like you said, it's a passion project. He had the passion for it as a young man, but I'm finding this out as I grow older, and I'm like, there are parts I just can't do anymore, but there are a whole bunch of new parts that I can do. You know, I mean, I've got this nice little silver beard right now at 44. So people could see me potentially as like a young grandfather. And I'm like, I get it. I totally get it. You know, I have friends from high school who are grandparents at my age. And I'm like, well, it's a thing. So
I have ex-girlfriends that are grandparents. Not me. Not mine. Well,
I think one thing that's interesting about this is maybe it didn't do so hot in 1939 because he just was in awe of Shakespeare as a young man. You know, he was in his early 20s or something. And then he gets to this age and he goes, now I get this character. Now I understand him a little bit better. That's something that I think, which is why he was able to succinctly take all those plays and condense them into a 2-hour thing. And it's still relatable and relevant. And there was like no part of that that felt like a lull to me, or it just moved. It was really great.
And I mean, the dialogue and the performances really carried it. I mean, the performances were superb, and you know, bigger than life in some ways. It was, I was such a hard art house film lover in my youth, you know,
anything indie is great.
Anything, man. And my true film education, came after Pepperdine, and I met this wonderful guy, Dave, who was leasing the screening room for a band apart, Quentin Tarantino's company. Tarantino had his own private screening room, and he'd given up the lease, and my friend Dave had done it. And Dave was truly like one of the people that I met that was the most genuine lover of film, and would watch any kind of film and appreciated everything for where it was and in its place and its history. And we used to go, me and my friends, because if he didn't have screenings, he just loved movies. So we would literally go and watch 3 movies back to back in this private, like 25 seat recliner theater. You know, that's rolling amazing. Up joints, hanging out till 4 o'clock in the morning, you know, sipping on whiskey and drinking and smoking bud and just like educating ourselves. And I saw the most wild things, but absolutely, as I've gotten older, I have less desire to watch art house films as I do to be entertained. But this was, you know, so for me to go and watch a Criterion film, if I'm going to do it, generally a very specific reason or something, like I want to learn something or I want to watch some specific piece of classic film history. So this was kind of fun to do outside of that. And truly, as one of the things I enjoyed the most out of it was seeing how much it affected modern cinema in particular.
Oh man.
Talking about that fight sequence, dude, the whole time I was watching that, I just kept going Game of Thrones theme, Game of Thrones. And Mike's bats his head in. Oh my God. That's crazy.
Yeah. Like, yeah, I was impressed by that too. Seeing a guy get hit over the head with a club and then, you know, it's black and white, but you're like, oh God, that's blood streaming down his face. And whoa,
that was pretty graphic. And again, I can't off the top of my head, like Kurosawa is probably what I know best.
Yeah.
Throne of Blood, which is a lot of other Shakespeare, ironically, yeah, exactly. Right? Throne of Blood, exactly. Ron being Macbeth, and Ron, but I guess those got somewhat graphic, but I felt like this was a pretty brutal war scene for the time period in particular.
And I think, honestly, even though that scene was so well shot and so amazing, I think my favorite thing was watching John Falstaff go hide behind the bushes every time something happened.
And then his fat suit of armor, man. I mean, it was. And then when he's lying on the ground at the end, and Hal comes up and flips his thing, his hood open.
Yeah.
And he's so pathetic and so good. And it's a great juxtaposition. He's so out of place and so comical in the middle of this really violent, dark battle of all these people getting exhausted and losing his life. There he is.
I ran around for 3 hours and my armor made me tired.
Yeah. Speaking of looking at that, also, if you look at how that's shot, mm-hmm. the battle is very dark. It's a lot of diffusion and smoke, right? And
yes.
And it's muddy and dirty. And I mean, they're literally all covered in mud and rolling in the mud. And and you see people flailing for their lives, kicking as their lives are leaving their bodies. And then you see grumpy, shiny Falstaff all alone, like where everybody else is in this twister pool of bodies. He's flopping around like the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
The thing that I loved about that character in those choices was I wanted him to find some guy who might have been stabbed and was almost dying. And then he goes and delivers the final blow and you know, basically takes claim for the kill. And that is an interesting thing because he does that with Harry Hotspur.
Yeah.
Just totally denying.
Oh, he got up after you killed him.
Yeah, exactly. And totally denied Hal his victory, which is funny. To me, that's kind of the crux of the interesting thing about it is that made this plot, the plot line, very Shakespearean in that Hal's question of which father is he going to follow, Gintz answered in the middle. The climax is in the middle of the play.
Yeah.
And we just get to see what decisions he makes through the end of the rest of the show. But
yeah, that's definitely the turning point. And mm-hmm. that's really astute and interesting point that the climax happens so early.
Yeah.
And it's a hell of a climax. I mean, it's coming off of that huge battle, but I think that is such a great time because that is when he sees the truth. That's when he knows, like he has just been through a battle, not just through fighting all those guys, but then killing. Well, in some ways they almost had a kinship, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Early on. And so there's, mm-hmm. even though there's that inner turmoil, there was also a lot of respect. And so when he had to choose to kill the man he respected, and then his father who ultimately should be giving him that respect instead stabs him in the back and takes his credit. It's him walking back to the line of soldiers. That's where the change happens. It's right there. You watch him. He drops the helmet, releasing, this is what I was a part of. I no longer believe in it.
So here's something interesting that I think about this. We're talking about this. This is really a story about Hal's journey from boy to king, right?
Yeah.
But it's called Falstaff. It's called Chimes at Midnight. It's Falstaff remembering his life up to that point. I mean, it starts with him sitting down with that old man and says, "We've heard the chimes at midnight," and got his great booming huge voice, which makes me remember one of his very last screen roles was Unicron, the major antagonist in the animated Transformers movie.
Whoa, I forgot about that.
He was the planet.
Optimus Prime.
Rise, Galvatron. Anyway, okay.
Yeah. That's pretty damn good, Darren.
So here's what I've kind of come up with. To put it in perspective, the best way I can put it is that in each play in which he's featured, Falstaff serves kind of the same function as like a Han Solo in the Star Wars movies, or as like Merry and Pippin in the Lord of the Rings movies. They're these lovable and charismatic scamps with bad reputations who always seem to be in some sort of trouble, but are absolutely essential to the victory of the protagonist. Even though they like their contributions have been slight, but essential.
Also, they're the narrator in many ways, right? So, so this is Prince Hal's story as told by Falstaff.
Exactly.
Who is an what's interesting is Falstaff is an unreliable narrator, but in this, he's not. He recognized himself, but in the end, he has to deal with the reality of what has happened and what has gone on, right? So it's kind of interesting. He's a very interesting character.
I know that in the plays he is given a death off screen in the Battle of Agincourt, but in this one, this is a totally Orson Welles invention of having Hal banish him and then him just kind of slowly walking off and dying off screen, of course, but they basically said he died of a broken heart. Like the joy had gone out of his life.
That's a very Grecian technique.
Yes.
And of Sophocles Oedipus, he finds out that his hubris has distracted him this whole time, right?
Yep.
Same, very, very, there's a lot of identical things here. And he finds out that through that, he, you know, has been with his mother and killed his father, and he goes off screen, blinds himself, and then is exiled.
Yeah. I think that's interesting. They don't kill him, but he does the violence off stage and then comes back, and everybody goes, wow, that was brutal.
That's all right. Now get out of here. take your curses with you and skedaddle.
We've gotten all we could out of you. Thank you very much. Which is kind of what Hal says to Falstaff at the end. I've gotten what I could out of you. I've outgrown you. Fuck off.
Yeah. and also, I think it's a great that ending that you're talking about, where their last interaction, where they both have truly become have leaned fully into that person that they're going to be, you know, even to the point where as Falstaff is leaving, dude's like, yo, he's like, I got your $1,000. Don't worry about it. And he's like, yeah, but I'd really, you know, you can just give me 500 now. It'd be all right. Like, and he's like, nah, I'm good for it, Dad.
I can't stop.
He can't stop. Even on death, he's not doing what's right. Even when he knows that he's exiled and he's going, he's still living in his hubris of thinking that I'm going to do the right thing. I'm going to be this person that I never have been, you know, that truly, if you look at his actions, he wasn't that.
Oh, no. So I tell you what, man, I will wrap this up with a great quote. And it comes directly from Welles about John Falstaff. It's a little longer, so here it goes. Falstaff is the most unusual figure in fiction. He is almost entirely a good man, a glorious, life-affirming good man, and there is hardly a good man in dramatic literature. There has always been an England, an older England, which was sweeter, purer, where the hay smelled better and the weather was always springtime and the daffodils blew in the gentle warm breezes. You feel a nostalgia for it in Chaucer. You feel it all throughout Shakespeare. Falstaff is a refugee from that world. He has to live by his wits. He has to be funny. He has no place to sleep if he doesn't get a laugh out of his patron. It's a rough modern world that he's living in. You've got to be able to see that look in his eyes that comes out of the age that never existed, the one that exists in the heart of all English poetry. End quote.
You know, I don't know if you know this, but Falstaff is the only character in those plays that isn't a real historical person.
Oh yeah, in the histories, right? Yeah.
So that's kind of an interesting thing also, that all of the real people are kind of shitty.
Right.
So it's just an interesting that the good character is not based on a real person. You know?
Yeah, what's Shakespeare trying to say with that? All of you people that are living in this world where we have these stupid political alliances, if you do that, I'll do this. If you mm-hmm. promise this, I will deliver this. Falstaff's just going, I'd like to have a drink and, you know, maybe get a girl in bed tonight. Anybody up for that?
Yeah. That is your everyman, right? Probably that's why we love and relate to Falstaff, even though he's flawed as he is. Oh, he's everyman, you know?
Or what everyman would want to be.
Maybe, yeah.
But I mean, the reality of it is, yeah, there are those complications in life, you know? I just spoke to a good friend who teaches high school and junior high students English and history. And she's developed this system where if a student just has a question about the world, you know, sometimes it can come from an authority figure at school or something. And so she says, just go ahead and drop me your questions. She's now writing a book based on these questions that one kid has brought forth. And they're things like, why do we have to have money?
Do we have to have money?
Do we have to have money? You know, and yeah. They're these great, big, yeah. huge, fat questions. But it's like, you know,
yeah.
initially we go, well, you have to have money because you have to pay for these things. Yeah, but why? Well, because we don't pay for these things and we don't get these things. Well, why can't you just get those things?
Yeah. You know? It's why can't we trade goods and services for other goods and services, right?
Yeah.
Ultimately, no, we've got a bank. Well, we can't do that because there's a bank that takes a piece of the money and creates debt off of that, creating forever slavery. So,
okay. But see, that's also a reality of the world, where you could look at life through the Falstaffian eyes, or you could look through Hal's eyes, and he goes, "This is fun," but at some point, you gotta straighten up.
This is real. This is, I know. You can only plug your ears and close your eyes for so long, you know?
Right.
Well, ultimately, Falstaff has a pretty sad existence in the end.
Yeah.
He ends alone, mm-hmm. you know, banished mm-hmm. and heartbroken.
Yeah. Well, you know, here we are in election year. And I think this is a very funny thing where you have both sides claiming to be the more patriotic one and, you know, yeah. acting like there haven't been inherent problems with this country since its very inception. You know, we are the inheritors of the legacy. It's like, well, the legacy does have a lot of strings attached to it. So,
yeah.
I don't know. I think it's interesting how people will want to ignore some of the more complicated parts of life just so they can say the life that they're living is pretty damn good. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I watched some YouTube video the other day of a lecture. And this professor had his students say, repeat the same phrase like three times. Mm-hmm. And then he played this thing of people chanting. And it sounded just like what you had just said. And then he goes, okay, now say this. And it's something completely different. And all of a sudden it sounds like the people are saying that. And he went through like seven or eight different iterations of the wording. But ultimately what you believe is what you hear.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah. It's important to be aware of that, I think. You know?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But I think that's a purpose of a piece like this, is to kind of remind us that, yes, there can be fun and yes, there can be serious things, but going extreme on either way can be dangerous.
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, there we go. Chimes at Midnight, Brand. I give it a thumbs up.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. That was fun.
I mean, this is going to be one that I probably will go back and watch again. Sometimes you watch something to just be like, okay, I'm doing this for a purpose. Like I'm researching this for this show. And then I may never see it again, but this one, I'm like, I enjoyed the performances a lot. I enjoyed the settings. I enjoyed, the story it's telling, and the fact that you get a tragic hero out of John Falstaff at the end, where you're like,
yeah,
I feel bad for you, man, but you can't just have fun all the time.
That we could, Aaron. Mm, indeed.
Quite the eloquent little ending, if you ask me. And Falstaff doesn't die in quite the bombastic way in which he lived. What's the phrase? Not with a bang, but with a whisper. Man, I truly enjoyed talking about this with Brand Birtwistle, and I'm certain to get him on again. I wish him the best with his original projects he's working on and anything else that comes his way. And listeners, thank you. If you've enjoyed the show, please go give the show a review wherever you listen. It really helps the show out. However, I'll sign off now. This has been another episode of Euripides Eumenides, a theater history podcast. I have been your host, Aaron Odom. Another episode will be in your ears in 2 weeks, and I will see you at intermission.